challenger Charlie Crist edges forward in the race to the governor's mansion. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend. And coming up, we'll have the results of UNF's new poll looking at the state of the governor's race. Who will get your vote? You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. That's just ahead. Also this morning, a St. Augustine woman's incredible story of her family's connection to the notorious Shelton Gang. Plus, sports with Cole Pepper, all of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, we're just a few weeks out until Election Day here in Florida. And lots of discussion around the country about a new poll out of UNF showing Charlie Crist with a 5-point lead over Governor Rick Scott. So we're beginning the hour with a closer look at where things stand in the Florida governor's race and also what this poll revealed on a number of issues important to Floridians. Dr. Michael Binder, UNF Assistant Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of UNF's Public Opinion Research Laboratory, led this polling effort, and he joins us now with all of the results. Mike Binder, always a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And here's our question to callers. Right now, we want you to let us know who will be getting your vote in the Florida governor's race. Election Day is coming up in a few weeks. Who do you like? Governor Scott, Charlie Crist, or another candidate? Give us a call right now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on Facebook. And so this new statewide poll, Mike, reveals Charlie Crist now with a 5 percentage point lead over Governor Scott.
Yeah, and some other polls have shown this trend as well. Rick Scott had taken a big, not only say a big lead, but he'd taken a lead over the summer. Charlie Crist had been quiet with his campaign spending. That has since changed in the last month and a half, and you see Crist gaining back some of the votes that were lost over the summer.
Was this surprising to you?
I think what was most surprising to me was the support for the Libertarian candidate, Adrian Wiley. Florida traditionally does not have a very supportive stance on alternative party candidates. We've never seen anything above 3%, and he's polling at 10% in our poll and almost double digits in many others.
That's almost unprecedented for a Libertarian candidate in a statewide race, isn't it?
In this state, absolutely.
Let's talk about the reasons why. You've got an incumbent governor with high negatives. You've got a former governor seeking to reclaim his old office with high negatives. Both of these candidates have serious baggage. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. One is just the tenor of the campaign. It's been so negative on both sides. So that's driven down the likability factor for both candidates. Additionally, Charlie Crist has a problem in that he left the Republican Party, and some Democrats aren't necessarily convinced he's a true Democrat. On the other side of the issue, you have Rick Scott, who ran on a jobs platform back in 2010, has been successful in creating jobs, however, has alienated some constituencies, particularly with some cuts to education. And he also has some personal difficulties in relating to people on a large scale. So those are some of the problems that these candidates have.
And so with a few weeks out till Election Day, we're just now getting into the window when all of the big money is about to be spent, most of it on TV in the large media markets, South Florida, Orlando, Tampa, up here. Governor Scott's war chest far outstrips anyone else in the race, whether it's Charlie Crist, Adrian Wiley. Do you think in the end that will tell the tale?
I think it's all going to be about turnout, and not just Democrats and Republicans, but geographic Democrats and Republicans. If Charlie Crist can get the South Florida vote out, it bodes well for him. If that vote stays suppressed like it did in 2010, then and Rick Scott can motivate Northern Florida independents and Republicans, it bodes very well for the governor.
We'll go to your calls on the state's governor's race in a moment at 549-2937. As a new UNF statewide poll shows Charlie Crist 5 points ahead of Governor Scott. Now, in addition to that, you also polled on a few other issues, including Amendment 2. That's the statewide ballot amendment that would allow for the medical use of marijuana. Let's talk about those results.
Yeah, this is, Florida, not exactly the most liberal state when it comes to drug use policy. And we're at 67% supportive for Amendment 2, which if you hear that number, you're like, wow, that's great support. But in Florida, there is a high bar for passing constitutional initiatives at 60%. So while, yes, it's over that bar, it is far from a given that this will pass.
Do you think that Amendment 2 being on the ballot will affect the outcome of the governor's race, as some have speculated?
Well, it's a very complicated issue. One, competitive ballot measures like this, and there's research out there that shows it, can bump up percentage turnout by a point or two. That would tend to help Charlie Crist. All the likely voter turnout models, the better the turnout, the better it is for him. However, with Adrian Wiley as an option, who's not only very much in favor of medical marijuana, but also recreational marijuana, some of those new votes might go to him as well.
And is Wiley's candidacy, in your view, going to harm Governor Scott more or Charlie Crist more in terms of siphoning votes away from disaffected constituents?
Initially, you might think it would injure Rick Scott. However, Our polling showed that when Wiley's in the race, he pulls almost evenly. And if you think about this a little bit more, it makes a little bit of sense. Republicans tend to be much more hands off from the government as far as regulation on business. Well, that's a libertarian platform. Democrats tend to be much more hands off on social policies, which is also the libertarian platform.
Right.
So you're pulling from a little bit of each.
Well, in the meantime, lots of calls as we begin Monday morning with a look at UNF's new statewide poll, giving us a snapshot into the governor's race just a few weeks out until Election Day. UNF saying Charlie Crist is now out in front of Rick Scott, but we want to know who has your vote. Will it be the governor, Charlie Crist, the libertarian Adrian Wiley, perhaps? And why? Let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Diane in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hi, Diane. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes. You asked who I would vote for. I would vote for Rick Scott. And the reason I would vote for Rick Scott is we need a leader who will manage the budget and manage all the departments of the government and make sure that we are in balance. And Rick Scott has done that. He's demonstrated that he's a very careful, fiscally responsible governor. And unfortunately, Charlie Crist never did that while he was in office. So I think the record speaks for itself. I want somebody who is going to streamline government and to make sure that the services are provided, but not at a cost we can't afford. So I would vote for Rick Scott.
All right, and that's Diane in Ponte Vedra. Thank you for the call, Diane. Mike.
Well, Diane brought up an interesting point that she alluded to, and it hints at managing government and working with government. If Charlie Crist were to win, he is going to be facing, at best, a Republican-dominated legislature, perhaps even a supermajority from the Republicans. How Charlie Crist can work with that opposition legislature, a party that he left and many feel betrayed in, would certainly be interesting and a difficult challenge for him.
Yeah, is that, I mean, it certainly wouldn't be unprecedented.
No, absolutely not unprecedented, but certainly a challenge that he would have to face.
And let's go now to Paul in Orange Park. Hey, Paul, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning, yes. Melissa, as always, your topic is a very important one. Rick Scott has taken more than $100 million out of the school budget at, 3 years ago, and in spite of the fact that we've had a surplus of $2 or $3 billion in the last two fiscal years, he hasn't put any back. He also took pensions away from new hires for teachers. Pension is one of the few things that motivates people to go into teaching because it's a thankless job. And he may be a good, he is a good businessman, that's obvious, but he sees himself as the CEO of Florida, not the governor. You can't, a person like me cannot get an interview with him, a talk with him, an appointment with him. You have to talk to one of his assistants. To put the icing on the cake, he chose a black woman as a running mate. Well, nobody has to be terribly bright to figure out that he did that intentionally to get the part of the black vote without her, he wouldn't have won, even after spending $73 million of his own money. And then he fired her after he got elected. So I'm definitely going with Charlie Crist. No, he doesn't walk on water. He doesn't turn rocks into bread or anything like that. But I think he honestly cares more about the people than Charlie Crist, who cares more about the big business and money.
All right, and that's Paul in Orange Park this morning. Thanks, Paul. Man, talk about damning with faint praise. Charlie Crist doesn't turn rocks into bread, but I like him. I dislike him a little less than I dislike Rick Scott.
And that's not uncharacteristic.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he said, of course. But
and that's not uncharacteristic of how a lot of voters feel about these two candidates. Neither one of them are great candidates. They're not leaders. They're not motivating. They're not driving people that are excited to show up and vote for them. So if that happens, you could expect turnout to be lower. And with lower turnout, whichever party is more excited about their candidate. And right now, it looks like that's Rick Scott. So that's leaning. That's helping the Republicans.
Hmm. Steve in Riverside. Hey, Steve, what are your thoughts?
I was just listening to your conversation, and I don't hear anybody talking about Adrian Wiley. And I suggest that the lady from Boca Vista go to wileyforgovernor.com and take a look at his economic plan, because he's a lot more fiscally conservative than Rick Scott.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve. And we actually did talk about him a few moments ago, but he'll definitely get your vote.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm voting for him. For the reason why I'm voting for him is I believe that both Rick Scott and Charlie Crist are crony capitalists, and Adrian Wiley is against that.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for the call. You know, it's remarkable, too, Mike, the degree to which this governor's race has generated national attention and none of it positive.
None of it's been positive. There's been, it seems like every year there's a race or two or three that takes the headlines for being the dirtiest race of the year and the most negative race and the most spending. And we're it this year.
This is it this year.
And it seems like Florida always finds itself in national headlines for political news, and it's very rarely good, positive news.
Which has become a punchline in a way, but hey, it keeps you busy, right?
Job security.
Yeah. 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts right now about who will get your vote in the governor's race. We'll go to your tweets and emails in just a moment. Let's go to Linda in Bay Meadows. Hey, Linda, good morning.
Good morning. I was calling hoping that people will, you know, we tend to have very short memories. I just want to put out there, you know, people have an issue with Charlie Crist because they said he switched, blah, blah, blah. But let's just focus on the governor we have who took, you know, millions of dollars out of the budget, and now he's proposing to put that back in, you know. Wow, I'm going to put money back in education. Well, it's probably a net zero because he cut so much in the beginning. We're moving to privatize the prisons. He's on his fourth or fifth, you know, prison person, and prisons are dying left and right in the prison population. He rejected high reach failed billions of dollars and Medicaid funding for people to get health insurance. So what do we have an outbreak here in Florida, and you have a lot of people who aren't insured? What in the world would we be thinking to reelect this person? It would be for the few who are secure. For the rest of us, please let's give Charlie Crist another chance. Thank you.
That's Linda in Bay Meadows. Thanks, Linda. Yeah, Charlie Crist is asking the state's voters to essentially, as she said, give him another chance.
And this is one of the dichotomies of the Scott administration and some of the problems that he's facing. The economy has turned around. Jobs are up, unemployment's down. However, early in his term, he did make huge cuts to education, huge cuts to social services. He was unable at the last minute to get Republicans on board with Medicaid expansion. At the same time, Charlie Crist was in a position back in 2009 and 2010 where the economy was tanking around the world, and he's seen it as getting up and leaving and running away. And how do you balance those two things? And Floridians are having a tough time.
Meanwhile, we're getting so many calls, emails, and tweets as we talk politics this morning on this show. Just a few weeks out from the Florida governor's race in November, a new UNF poll shows Charlie Crist is now pulling ahead of Rick Scott by about 5 points. Lots of emails. Here's one from a listener. One caller just stated that Scott took money out of education and didn't put it back. That's inaccurate. He dedicated $1 billion back to education in Florida. I'm voting for Rick Scott. Here's another email from Paul in St. Johns County. Charlie has my vote. Interesting how he refers to him by his first name. For too many reasons, from education to public safety, Scott has been a terrible governor. We know Charlie and believe he will do a better job. And then on Twitter, did the poll include asking voters about Amendment 1? That might drive some people to the polls. That's the amendment that would preserve environmentally sensitive lands. We can talk about that in just a moment. And then on Facebook, Ted writes, I'm just going to pick the lesser of two evils. Oh, boy. All right. So lots of feedback, Mike.
There's a lot of good stuff in there. And you alluded to it with the Charlie comment. Charlie Crist is a lot more likable. He has that let's go get a beer with you and chat feel.
Yeah, I mean, nobody is going to call the governor Rick. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I mean, and in your view, though, that type of intangible thing, does that make a difference?
Sure, it absolutely makes a difference in a race that's close, and it also might motivate some people to go out and vote. Is it going to move somebody who is a Republican over to voting for Charlie Crist? Probably not. But might it motivate somebody to say, you know, I really like that Charlie guy. I'm going to show up and vote for him.
What about some of the tweets about other ancillary issues that might get people to the polls, like some of these ballot amendments?
The thing with, particularly with Amendment 1, if you know about Amendment 1, you're already going to vote, or you've already mailed in your ballot. So Amendment 1 isn't, there's no spending on it. It's very complicated. It's moving, it's shifting money around. It's dedicating money to the land trust fund from the excise tax. But on the flip side of that, it's because that money is now dedicated, it's going to have to be pulled from other sources. So what happens to the other sources where that revenue was originally going to go? That's something that the governor and the state legislature are going to have to figure out.
549-2937, jammed lines, as we ask you right now this morning, First Coast. Who will get your vote in the governor's race? The election's just a few weeks away. Let's go now down to Flagler Beach. It's Joe in Flagler Beach. Hey, Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm just amazed. I'm listening to the conversation, and I very strongly feel that Chris is far better than that Scott ever thought about being. The very nature of Scott, I mean, he came into a public view, you know, almost 15 years ago, 20 years ago, with his, you know, just total disruption of a major medical corporation, and then, you know, I ran that one into the ground and managed to basically take the fifth so that he didn't go to jail, turn on his friends, and made hundreds of millions of dollars off of that. And then, you know, he touts his coming from grassroots, coming from a trailer park and being the, you know, good old boy. It's like, come on, you know, you made your money by stealing it, and now you just want to steal more of ours. So I tend to lean very strongly towards Chris. He may not be perfect, but, you know, as a lot of your listeners are saying, far less of two evils.
That's Joe in Flagler Beach. Mike, will the governor's business background hurt him this time or no?
I think particularly the Medicare fraud stuff, that was worked through in the first election.
Yeah, yeah.
And if that wasn't going to keep him out then, I don't think it would keep him out now. I think what really is on the issue is what he's done over the last 4 years and if you're okay with that or not. And let's be clear, you know, Charlie Crist isn't your average working guy who's been working at the factory for the last 30 years either. So, you know, he's trial lawyer ties and all kinds of things like that. So, again, neither candidate is wonderful.
Mike on the West Side. Hey, Mike, what are your thoughts?
How are we doing? Thank you for taking my call. My only comment is I'll be voting for the independent. I thought Rich Scott was a conservative. I guess I'm wrong. I thought that conservative, a cornerstone for conservatism was states' rights. He lost me when he gave up the states' right to control our own Medicare and our own medical system and gave it to the federal government. To me, that's not conservatism. I don't know what that is. He's a sheep, and I don't care for that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Man, yeah, no shortage of feedback today.
No, people are fired up.
Yeah, they are.
And that's great. You know, maybe they'll get out to vote. And, you know, it's not that the election starts 3 weeks from now. Absentee ballots have already been mailed out and sent back. And early voting starts a week from today.
Isn't that amazing? Gosh, it's really coming up quickly. More emails coming in. Dolly emails the show. Please clarify about those education cuts. The governor and the legislature cut $1.3 billion in education funding in their first year. They refunded $1 billion in subsequent years' funding. David writes, is the reason Scott turned down billions in Medicare money for Florida's uninsured because perhaps he's feeling guilty about the billions he already defrauded from the feds? Let's see who else here. Robert emails the show. To answer your question, I will not be voting because of Rick Scott's revocation of automatic restoration of civil rights for felons. Although I am more than 10 years out from my felony conviction, Scott has created hurdles to restore my rights. So many people getting in touch with us on all sorts of issues, and we want to get a few more calls on the air. Let's go to Chuck at the Beaches. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hi. You guys are talking about the likability of Charlie Crist. I think Rick Scott will win the debate. He's definitely going to win on the finance issue. And there's one thing that I heard on the radio the other day or read, and I think it's huge, talking about education. If I understand correctly, people in the Florida prepaid program will be getting refunds, and the cost of the Florida prepaid program for people who want to educate their children, will, the cost will be cut in half. If the Republicans did that, that is huge. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. You know, he mentioned the debate. There is going to be a debate hosted by Jake Tapper of CNN and Kent Justice of Channel 4, WJXT. That's going to be interesting. That's coming up soon.
That's great. It's a couple weeks away. It's on the 21st here in Jacksonville. It's exciting. We had a presidential primary debate on UNF's campus a couple years ago with the Republican candidates. It brings some enthusiasm to the area, and it brings some attention to the area, too, so that once these candidates, one of them's going to win, maybe even Adrian Wiley, and they're going to have
to... But they're not letting Wiley into the debate,
they're
are
not
they?
Letting Wiley
That's
into the
a matter
debate.
Of some controversy.
He's filed some lawsuits to get into another debate. We'll see how this goes. But one of the candidates is going to win, and they're going to have to govern. And North Florida, no matter who you vote for, you want to make sure that we get attention from Tallahassee once we get into the legislating season. John Thrasher's leaving. He's going to FSU. He was very powerful, very influential. Who's there to pick up that voice? And if we have a governor who feels indebted to the area for their turnout and their support, that goes a long way.
Well, we'll continue to follow it. And as always, so appreciate your insights. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Michael Binder is UNF Assistant Professor of Political Science. He also directs UNF's Public Opinion Research Laboratory. And much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the Jags loss yet again. Also, we'll tell you about Mammosphere, an important new advance during this Breast Cancer Awareness Month for women being treated for the disease. But up next, a St. Augustine woman's incredible story, her family's history inside the notorious Shelton Gang. That's next.
New archaeological evidence indicates that 1,000 years ago, native Floridians were trading with the Mississippian Society in what would become the Midwestern United States. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with archaeologist Keith Ashley. A look at maps of Florida from the 1500s and a discussion about the Ocoee Massacre of 1920. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
That sense of, I need to give out of obligation, I don't know that that's going to be around 20 years from now.
Millennials don't give to charities like older generations have, but that doesn't mean they don't give.
They want to feel like they're making an investment, that they are investing not just their capital, but they're investing emotionally.
Charity in the Millennial Age, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Broadway has never been broader. It's not just for gays anymore.
Neil Patrick Harris has won two Emmys for hosting the Tonys and won a Tony this year for playing the title role in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. On the next Fresh Air, Neil Patrick Harris tells us about performing on Broadway, surviving child stardom, and his new memoir. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, this is an incredible story. Ruthie Shelton of St. Augustine grew up in a loving home and everything seemed totally normal. But there was one thing no one in the family ever talked about, her father's past. When her dad grew ill and needed open heart surgery in 2003, he finally started opening up and talking to his daughter Ruthie about his early life. That's when she learned that her dad was one of the notorious Shelton Gang, a crime syndicate based in southern Illinois that rivaled Al Capone's group up in Chicago. Ruthie, an aspiring journalist, had the story of a lifetime, and she tells all in her fascinating new book, Inside the Shelton Gang, One Daughter's Discovery. Ruthie Shelton, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being with us. So you grew up in St. Augustine, a world away from organized crime in Illinois. An idyllic childhood, right?
Right. I grew up riding motorcycles, shooting guns, just your basic tomboy. Never had any idea of my dad's past.
But there was one sort of elephant in the room in your childhood, wasn't it? Like there was an element of secrecy in your family.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me what that was like?
Well, there was no questioning anything about my dad's past. I didn't know his family. I knew nothing about where he was born, nothing about his past whatsoever. If I ever questioned anything, it was hushed immediately.
What would they say to you? Your mom and dad?
Oh, absolutely. Can I give the one instance of when I found my sister's picture? I was a small girl, just going, you know, how you go through your parents' things and just kind of snooping. And I found a picture of the most beautiful little girl, blonde hair, blue eye, wearing a beautiful party dress and patent leather shoes and lace socks, just the total opposite of how I was being raised as such a tomboy.
Huh.
And I took it to my mom and I said, oh, who's this little girl? And she grabbed that picture, snatched it from my fingers. She said, that's your daddy's first daughter. That was the end of that discussion. The picture disappeared. It never was brought up again.
Wow. And so that went on for many years. And then your father needed surgery.
Absolutely. When his heart valve was wearing out, it was 2003, December, he had to have open heart surgery. I was very worried because he was close to 80 years old. But at this point, he hit it like he did everything in his life. Let's do it. And so he had the open heart surgery. It went very badly. He was unconscious for 5 days. And the doctors told me he might not come out. He might not have all his faculties when he comes out. But he went back in time as he started coming out of it in his mind to his gangster days and was reliving shooting and counting money and dealing cards and all these things that I couldn't imagine was part of his past. And as he became more coherent, he started telling me stories from his past.
What did he tell you?
The first moment I really paid attention, he actually grabbed me and said, no, you have to listen. And I realized what he was telling me was his past. He started telling me about his Uncle Carl that he was named after. I never knew about this person. How he was assassinated in the area that my dad had grown up in Wayne County. It was a small area called Pond Creek out of Fairfield, Illinois. And from there, he told me about other murders in his family and why his family had to leave the Midwest in 1951.
They were driven out?
They were driven out. Before that, they had had a working relationship with Al Capone, My dad used to drive his Uncle Bernie to St. Augustine, what is now Flagler College, to meet with Capone to keep peace between the two gangs, also to split up the take that would come in of the liquor runs. After Capone was out of the picture, my family had wronged quite a few people who were in different gangs in the Midwest. Well, those different factions came together and decided they wanted the territory that the Sheltons controlled in gambling, prostitution, alcohol, anything illegal.
Numbers.
They controlled it. Exactly. And they started assassinating the Sheltons to get that control.
And so your family fled to Florida.
They fled.
For their lives.
Yes, for their lives. Everything my family owned, homes, barns, was bombed, burned to the ground. And as a matter of fact, my great aunt and her husband had been shot. She was wounded so critically that she was in the hospital until the night the Sheltons left town. They took her out through the window of the hospital so no one would know they were leaving town.
Oh, my goodness.
And came to Jacksonville, Florida. And actually, it was here where they made their home.
So your father spills these incredible secrets on practically on his deathbed.
Yes.
How did that affect you?
At first, it had no effect whatsoever because I was concerned about my dad, his health, taking care of him. But as he recovered from the heart surgery and, you know, I would go out every day to his house and help to take care of him. His stories were just wonderful to me. This was a past. He wasn't just telling me the horrible. He was telling me the good stories, and they're all in my book. Mm-hmm. The things that I should have been told growing up, you know, the stories that a normal child hears sitting on her dad's knee as she's a little girl. I was treasuring these stories. I didn't know when they would end. I took note of them every day.
Wow. Because your story, I think so many people can relate to in that what makes a family is story. A family tells each other mm-hmm. its stories. And that
exactly.
that was withheld from you for so long. So any family that is made dysfunctional by mm-hmm. a big secret, you know, whether and that can be in all sorts of different ways.
Correct.
That really has profound effects on a family mm-hmm. unit, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And it goes down through the generations. I had no history. My children had no history. On my side of the family, passed me. It affected everything in life. It affected school projects, everything. As a matter of fact, one teacher when I was a kid said, well, maybe you were adopted. Well, no, I wasn't. But mm-hmm. now we know why. I could never fill in the gaps.
So how cathartic was it for you to write this story and put it on paper?
That was it. Put it on paper. That was how I lived my life. I wanted to be a writer since I could hold a pencil. Since I was 4 or 5 years old, that was what I was going to do. I was a journalist, as you mentioned, when I was in high school. But then life got in the way. Marriage, family, and life moved on. This was my moment. This was my time. I'm over 50. My children are grown. That was how I worked through it. I put it on paper.
And what's the reaction been?
It's been great. I have been so thrilled. I have met some of the most wonderful people all over this country you could ever imagine meeting. My husband is proud of me. My children are proud of me. My grandchildren are proud of me. I couldn't be happier.
And you're a new and vibrant voice in the community of authors here in Northeast Florida. And so we so appreciate you sharing this fascinating story with our listeners.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And pick up Ruthie's book. It's fascinating. Inside the Shelton Gang, One Daughter's Discovery by St. Augustine author Ruthie Shelton. And we're back in a moment. Thank you.
Listen to the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra every Monday night at 7 on 89.9 WJCT for the Concert of the Week.
There is a whole lot that goes into your morning glass of orange juice, you know? Citrus greening, labor issues, and high production costs.
We've actually had to identify some blocks over there that we've actually just walked away from.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, extra pulp in your business news. The numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
It's easy to listen to WJCT even when you're not near a radio. Just visit WJCTnews.org from your phone or tablet. On our mobile site, you're just one click away from a 24-hour live stream of our programming, and you'll also have easy access to all of the top local news stories. Listen live on WJCT's mobile website, WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back. Well, it's a huge leap forward for breast cancer screening. A new nonprofit here on the First Coast called Mammosphere is linking up all local breast cancer screening facilities by offering patients a secure cloud storage for their mammogram images. Now, this will allow different doctors to access the results, and it'll have the added benefit of reducing healthcare costs. This is all the brainchild of Dr. Catherine Pearson-Payton, a well-known local radiologist here in Jacksonville, and it turns out she's got a very personal connection to this issue. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and Dr. Pearson-Payton joins us now with more about Mammosphere. Doctor, good morning.
Thank you very much, Melissa, for having me.
So great to have you on the program. This is almost a revolutionary step forward, using digital technology to help women with breast cancer. How did you hit upon the idea for Mammosphere?
Well, with my experience as a breast imager and having diagnosed many, many breast cancers and seen women come in and not have their prior mammograms available for comparison, oftentimes causing for us to increase their additional imaging and have unnecessary biopsies and all that anxiety and cost, and then sometimes delaying their diagnosis. And I realized this is something that's so simple. We need to provide those prior mammograms, have them readily accessible to women wherever they move. And unfortunately, women are moving all over the place these days, and have those accessible for the physicians.
And so using cloud technology, you've been able to put this together.
Absolutely. And this is the day and age where really with healthcare, we need to have this available to women. And it really seems like a no-brainer. And why we're not doing it readily right now is really a difficult issue for me to watch. And so what we've done is we've pulled together a tremendous team of my colleagues from Stanford who have a great background in cloud consulting and business. And we have a wonderful back-end technology company called ITMD. And we've got a platform that we've now introduced into Jacksonville. And we're trying to connect all of the breast centers so that women, when they're bouncing between breast centers or they have prior mammograms from out of state, we have those readily available. It turns out that research shows that when those prior mammograms are available, we pick up breast cancer 25% earlier, stage 0 or 1. And that's huge. If you were to have me here tell you about a new technology that detects breast cancer 25% earlier, it would be headline news across the country.
Absolutely. And so as you pilot this in Jacksonville, you're going to partner with both Florida Blue, UF and Shands, and I guess hopefully more.
Well, we are. We've got tremendous, it's a collaborative effort, really, and we're partnering with the Florida Blue Foundation and University of Florida Health is performing our outcomes project. We have support from the Department of Health and certainly also tremendous help from the Riverside Hospital Foundation. And this really will show with the insurers and the hospitals and the patients all coming together to make this accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. And so not only do we have this image exchange network, but women can go onto our website and electronically store their own images in their own free personal mammography record, which allows them to have all of their images. And this is particularly important for women who have high risk for breast cancer or have had a history of breast cancer or have moved around the country.
Now, in addition to your professional interest in this, your family history motivated you as well, correct?
That's absolutely true. I had three generations of my family affected by breast cancer, beginning with my great-grandmother, who died of metastatic breast cancer in her 50s. And this was long before they had breast cancer screening and no mention of self-breast exams. And then my great-grandmother herself had breast cancer in her 40s and underwent a horribly deforming and old-fashioned radical mastectomy, which really left her psychologically crippled and inactive for the rest of her life. I was surrounded as well by my mother and my aunts having breast cancer. Fortunately, it was like we were reading the story of progress of breast cancer because each of them required less extensive surgery and had more reconstruction options, and the chemotherapies were less toxic and more targeted.
Mm-hmm. And then yourself, you became even more involved with your own story.
Well, of course. I was undergoing my medical training in San Francisco, and I met with a geneticist there who told me I had an 85% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. So I learned everything I possibly could to know about it by becoming a breast imaging radiologist, and I started my own screening mammograms when I was 30, and then underwent MRI screening, which eventually, unfortunately, showed abnormalities in both breasts about 3 years ago. And so having been surrounded by my entire family having breast cancer, and then as well having diagnosed thousands of women with breast cancer, I was really comfortable with undergoing the decision to have mastectomies, and so I did. But that was a real wake-up call towards my life, and I decided at that point I really wanted to be with my family and be with my kids.
And not only did you save your own life, with creating Mammosphere, I think it's a guarantee that you're going to save other women's lives.
Well, this has the opportunity to really improve breast cancer detection and also reduce healthcare costs. We have exorbitant healthcare costs going towards unnecessary additional imaging. And just by having that prior mammogram available, we reduce those unnecessary exams by 60%, mm-hmm. which really translates into a huge amount of wasted money, wasted and unnecessary anxiety, and certainly unnecessary radiation.
So sign up is free, by the way. How can people, how can doctors, women that are listening, how can they learn more? How can they make sure they're plugged into this?
Well, certainly, I think being aware of this and asking your physician and your facility to implement this free technology is something that they can do. I think women as advocates can really push for this, as we should. And they can go to our website at mammosphere.org and access Mammosphere to start their own personal mammography record for free. And they can upload and store their own exams, up to 10 of them for up to 10 years. And then certainly as well, they could help with either signing our petition on change.org or going to the Harvard Healthcare Innovation Forum, where we have an application that apparently is way up there amongst 481 applications. And if we can get this really going here in Jacksonville and prove the value that we see in the radiology literature, this could have a tremendous effect on women across the country.
Well, kudos to you. And it truly is an incredible idea and brilliant in its concept and execution. And so thank you so much during Breast Cancer Awareness Month for sharing this with us. Again, it's mammosphere.org. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
She's Dr. Catherine Pearson Payton, the founder of Mammosphere. Again, that website is mammosphere.org. Check it out today. And Culpepper's up next. Stay with us.
All your favorite oldies tonight at 10 on Route 66, only on 89.9 FM.
And Antiques Roadshow is discovering Florida's treasures in Jacksonville.
It is the cleanest Fender Telecaster of this period I have ever seen, ever.
I am shocked. Cool.
I have to tell you, maybe I'm going to get a couch here. You're kidding.
No, I'm being very serious.
Wow.
Next time from Jacksonville on Antiques Roadshow.
Tonight at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Join us for a musical journey that began more than a century ago. Blues Horizon, for the best in classic and modern blues. Tonight at 11 on 89.9 FM, community-supported public radio.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
And welcome back. Well, finally this hour, they're getting closer, but the Jaguars lose again.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here now, and you know, the most awful tweet I saw this weekend, Cole, was, are the Jaguars the Chicago Cubs?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
It's been a long
time for the Cubs. Year they go, we're going to do it this year. This is the year we're going to do it.
And truthfully,
that's been going on for how many decades?
Truthfully,
now?
Next year was the year the Jaguars expected to do it. And by that, I mean be in the playoffs and make that. But you would expect to see some improvement over time. Before
right.
I get into the Jaguars, let me just take a moment to congratulate you and the entire First Coast Connect team.
Thanks.
Producer Sean Birch in there and everybody else for winning Folio Weekly's favorite local radio show, and you for winning Folio Weekly's favorite local radio host.
Thank
Congratulations.
You. Thank you, sir. And I do believe you were mentioned in that same poll. So as always, you are one of the deans of Jacksonville sports broadcasting.
I think that just means I'm getting older.
So let's
talk about
all?
The Jaguars. I want to play a game of optimist versus pessimist with regard to the Jaguars. Their 16-14 loss to the Titans. If you're on the optimistic side, you could say the Jaguars have become more competitive. They cut the margin of defeat the last 5 weeks from 31 to 24 to 19 to 8 to just 2 yesterday. So you know, that's an improvement. They were actually in position to win until Josh Scobie's 55-yard field goal was blocked in the final seconds. Blake Bortles looks like the real deal. Threw for 336 yards, led the team with 38 rushing yards yesterday. Jaguars showed great resilience after falling behind 16-7 and losing possession in the fourth quarter when Cecil Shorts fumbled at the Titans' 10 with 5 minutes remaining. Bortles led them back on a touchdown drive, found Clay Harbor with 37 seconds remaining. Then they recovered an onside kick to get in position to win.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, there's some things you can build on. If you want to play the role of pessimist, and it's a pretty easy role
pretty
to play
easy
right
to do,
now,
yeah.
You could say it's a bottom-line business and the Jaguars are 0-6 for the second straight year. And you'd be right. Last year's first-round pick, Luke Jokel, still hasn't looked the part. Offensive line took a step backwards after playing pretty well against the Steelers. They gave up 6 sacks yesterday. The running game's been non-existent. That's why the quarterback is leading the team in rushing. And Shorts should be the one guy the offense can rely on. He's the only one besides guard Zane Beatles, who has logged substantial time as a starter in the regular season. Oh, and did I mention that it was Beatles who got beat on the blocked field goal?
Right.
And if you're really pessimistic, you might say, when is this so-called 3-year plan going to look like it's going anywhere?
Oh.
And unless they improve dramatically, who on their schedule are they going to be favored to beat?
Yeah, name one.
Well, okay, let's look at this. Cleveland, this on Sunday here in town, you'd say when the season started, hey, they could beat the Browns. But the Browns are 3-2, they just beat the Steelers.
Yeah,
Miami,
exactly.
Miami the next week, maybe, although Miami battled Green Bay right down to the wire. Cincinnati, then, after that, they lead the AFC North. Dallas and London, the Cowboys are tied for the best record in football. Then they go to Indianapolis. We saw what Andrew Luck did to the Jaguars here in Jacksonville. Then it's the Giants. We'll see there.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe December 7th, Houston Texans
nice
here in Jacksonville.
Nice little Christmas present.
Yeah, you know. Now, this doesn't mean that the Jaguars can't improve. They are young, and if there's two things about young teams, number one, they're inconsistent, and number two, they have a chance to get better.
When was the last time there was a fully winless season?
The Detroit Lions did that.
It was Detroit. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
2008.
We're not not there yet, but people are starting to think that.
I don't think that's going to happen. When you have a quarterback as talented as Blake Bortles, he's going to do something to win. The defense has played fairly well. They certainly are getting good pressure on the quarterback the last couple of weeks against less than top tier offenses. They've done fairly well. So I think there's something. I think they're going to win. I would like to see more progress as they ramp up toward, 2015.
Sure, wouldn't we all? If you weren't catching the Jaguars, chances are you were glued to your screen this weekend for college football. Lots to talk about.
Lots to talk about, including the Gators. If you're a Jaguars and a Gators fan, you had a rough weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
Gators had a chance to win. They trailed by 3 with less than 2 minutes to play, had the ball on the LSU 3-yard line. Jeff Driscoll's pass was flat-out dropped by Tevin Westbrook in the end zone. Would have been a go-ahead score. Instead, they settled for a field goal. LSU able to get an interception, sets up a game-winning field goal, and LSU wins. I think this is going to be a pivotal game for Florida, and we may look back at the end of the year and say that's where it turned, and that's where that was the beginning of the end, unless they can turn things around against Missouri and Georgia here the next couple of games, which it is possible, but Florida's going to have to get things put together.
Now, last but not least, the Jacksonville Armada is sort of making its debut.
Yeah, they sort of played their first game last Saturday. It was a closed-door match. This is the Armada developmental squad. They beat one of the top soccer academies in the country, Montverde Academy, 2-1. Game-winning goal scored by a 15-year-old who has been described to me as having special talent by the Armada folks.
At the age of
15? At the age of 15. So he could develop into a star 2 or 3 years down the road, and that's one of the things they're looking for: is young stars that they can really grow. Regular roster for the Armada could get its first player in the next 3 or 4 weeks, according to general manager Dario Sala.
Not too far out at all. Yep. Lots of sports on the First Coast, and as always, you run it down for us brilliantly. So we so appreciate you stopping by every Monday. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Our intern is Annie Black. Our video stream volunteer today is Jim Weeks. And the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. If you have feedback about the program, just drop an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch the best moments from the week. It's on our Rewind show every Saturday at 4 o'clock. Coming up next on Diane Rehm, Pope Francis has brought together bishops from around the world to talk about issues like birth control, divorce, and the celibacy of priests. A discussion on the Roman Catholic Synod convening in Rome and the struggle for the heart of the church. That discussion's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, community-supported public radio. Your community, your world. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.